This is
you can edit
Tuesday,
out this waffle.
The 21st of November 2017.
Mm-hmm. You're Patrick Crozier.
I am indeed, and you're Brian Micklethwaite. Mm-hmm. And we were going to have another chat about television because we weren't very happy about the recording we made last week, which may or not get put onto the interweb.
Well, perhaps we can summarise it about 10 seconds. Well, more than that, the things we talked about in that. Basically, I said I love television for all the reasons that everybody else who loves television loves it. And the other thing, I'm not sure if I made it quite as clear as I'd like to, is that I think historians will be very... they'll pay very close attention to television as a big historical event. And part of an even bigger one, which began in 1844, I think, when they sent the first message faster than the speed of a galloping horse along some wires... somewhere on the east coast of America, I think it was, Samuel Morse. I think the whole progression from that moment is going to be seen as a very big deal, rather like we now think about printing. Lots and lots of historians discuss the printing press and its impact on European culture and the Bible and making the Bible available to all that sort of thing.
I mean, at the risk of talking about Morse, I mean, that is 170-odd years ago, so you would have thought...
Well, I'm looking 500 years ahead. I mean, just as we're that sort of time ahead from printing.
Oh, you think it's too early to tell?
What I mean is I think that printing will... television will be seen as part of a very big historical event, which is electronic communication in all its many forms.
Yeah.
And there may even be a footnote about fax machines. But they're unlikely to go into the minutiae of... politics and, you know, entire major heads of state will be forgotten, but they'll mention David Frost. You know, that's what history is likely to be like, it seems to me. It makes sense to me that it would. In other words, it's a big event. We're not talking about something trivial.
No, I don't think it's trivial at all. But what do we think the impact is? I mean, can we...
Well, I briefly sketched that one of the impacts was that it simply immobilised a lot of respectable people for hours on end, staring at a box instead of at what I suppose we could call real life. And that had effects on crime, because crime is all about surveillance.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's a big impact. But and also I said I don't think it's the content of television which has caused crime. If anything...
It's just the fact of the
nightly slaughter that occurs on TV every night in Oxford alone, never mind the rest of the world, is if people were copying that, we'd all be dead by now. They're not. It's quite obvious that people know the difference between fantasy and reality. And what they make of fantasy is all the question of what they already think. And if they already think it's bad to murder people, they're not going to go out and do it just because they've seen someone do it on, you know... Midsummer Murders. No. That and what was the third thing? Oh, the third thing was I think TV may very well have helped to win the Cold War big time by transmitting gorgeously attractive imagery of the free-ish countries to the tyrannized countries, which created havoc not just among the people but among the, you know, the children of the elite, for example. You know, they were the ones. And even the elite themselves.
Daddy can have a Barbie.
Yeah. Mm. So those were the big things I sort of came into the last week's conversation with in my head. Whether we now use that summary or the original version of the conversation, I don't know. It's up to you. But that's what that brings me up to date.
Right.
And if I can just say one further thing before turning the focus on you. I think that one of the advantages of doing conversations like this is that you find yourself answering questions that you, with an urgency that you wouldn't otherwise give to them. And literally minutes ago, I realised one of the big things I like about television and put it into words. And that is that as a libertarian, I'm sort of separated from other people. In Perry de Havilland's phrase, I have a different meta context about how the world works. I don't see it as the government's job to solve all problems, whereas if you walk into a random room picked with a pin in Britain, that's what most of the people in it are going to assume. The statement, this is a problem, and the government should do something about it, is seen as the same statement. Well, you and I both don't think like that. And this separates us from the rest of our fellow countrymen. And what I like about television is that it unites me with the rest of my fellow countrymen, because I don't just love it. I love it for all the reasons they love it. The excitement, the adventure, the attractive people, the witty things they say, the clever ways that they kill each other, pretending, you know, all that.
But don't you find the sort of... Well, to me, the problem, and one of the reasons I'm sort of alienated from a lot of TV, is the constant sort of socialist messaging that goes on. You know, the idea, you know, the you can, you must have, you know, nationalised hospitals, you must have nationalised law enforcement, you essentially must vote Labour. These sort of messages seem to me to be constantly...
Well, I quite like acquainting myself with these opinions, because, I mean, as libertarians, we spend our time arguing with them. I think it helps to know what they are and where they come from and what it would be like to think like that.
Well, I could watch 10 minutes of the news each day and that would tell me perfectly well.
Libertarians have different tastes in what they want to pay attention to, but one of the things I like about television is that it gives me things to write about critically, you know. But it does connect me to the people who made the programme and the people who watch it and agree with it, because here I am sitting there watching it with them. I think this impact of television was greater.
I suppose maybe one of the advantages is you're not in the same room as them.
Yes.
So you can swear at the television without actually, you know, losing all your friends.
Yes. But I don't spend a lot of my time swearing at the television. I switch it off quite often. I switch over. I think it makes a huge difference. There's a vast abundance of channels now. And if you don't like one pro... You know, most people don't like most of the shows on television.
I suppose we should point out to younger members of the audience that there was a time... Well, when I was growing up in the 70s, there were only three channels.
Yes. It was a different world. And I think I mentioned this as well. It was a world where social life would stop if a big TV show came on. Oh, another thing we said last time around was that recording was a big event. When that cut in, it made a big difference to life.
Well, my understanding is it made a big difference to television, because all of a sudden you could have episodic dramas. I mean, I know Doctor Who was an episodic drama from the 60s, but that's something of a special case, because all the other ones I can think of were not episodic.
Yes.
They were self-contained.
You couldn't catch up. Routinely we hear on the TV now, if you missed the first episode, you can get it on whatever the internet thing is that you can use to catch up. And if you miss the whole thing, you can still buy it and in whatever form you want. With me, it's DVDs because I'm an old geezer, but you don't have to. You can just tune into the internet and watch these things, can't you?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So you can have these sort of grand story arcs which last over several... Mm.
And I think that's had quite an impact on TV. I mean, I've been recording The A-Team, which was an 80s adventure story, and you had a variation on the theme of a one-off show, which is that every episode is the same. The plot is identical. as you say, there's no accumulating story going on. It's interesting that in the episode, more recently, in the later part of the series, I think the end of it, they did have an accumulating narrative. And I think that happened because at that point you could... that was when recording started to happen. I think that was in the 80s.
And how many episodes did this accumulating narrative...
Well, there were five... I think there were five series and the fifth one got cut off halfway through. But it was never the same. I mean, the original classic A-Team was just fatuously enjoyable. And I think they tried to make it rather better. And I'm afraid at that point, the basic ground rules turned around and bit them because they were so stupid. But like, nobody ever gets killed. Bullets full, you know, these crack adventurers or whatever, they, you know, crack...
special forces.
Yeah, well, they don't seem to be able to hit anything with a gun. I mean, it's just bizarre.
Aiming to miss.
And whenever anything explodes, they sort of jump in the air and don't get hurt. It's crazy. So that and you can't make that not pantomime. So that's why it stopped.
Oh, they I see. So they made a better programme and lost all their audience.
Yeah,
Right.
Well, they made a worse program, actually, because they made a program where it wasn't clear what the rules were. I mean, imagine trying to make a pantomime more realistic. It, you know, by introducing modern themes about housing shortages or so, you know, it unless you do it well, it could be just disastrous. And it's like, I think it was like that.
Anyway, how do we get on to
anyway?
That?
I want to forget about me.
That's on my record. Yes,
what
okay.
do you think of my opinions? No, I want to ask you, which television did you like? And I've already said how television relates to my libertarianism. It relates to it by not being libertarian, and that I kind of like that. What about you? Which are the shows you liked most?
Well, I mean, the big one is Doctor Who. That was a lot to me when I was a child. Although, actually, now that you have DVDs, you have the opportunity to look back at the ones you watched. You realise you didn't watch them for that long. But then, I guess children have very low attention spans, so. And are very critical as well. I can remember one edition, one episode was called Invasion of the Dinosaurs, which came out in 1974 or thereabouts. And the dinosaurs are crap. They looked absolutely ridiculous, and I stopped watching it. So I never found out what happened, because I didn't really care what happened.
It was just the moment-by-moment immersion in this drama. Is that what you're saying? And because of these stupid dinosaur costumes, that became impossible and unenjoyable.
Yes. I guess. I've never really analysed it in any detail.
Our old friend, the suspension of disbelief.
Which is odd, because everything in Doctor Who is ridiculous,
yes,
really.
Yes. Well, most of the stuff on television is ridiculous, but you want to sort of believe it, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah,
want to be able to get into it.
But you know, I like Doctor Who. No matter what my political opinions were, they have changed over the years.
Given that Doctor Who is one of your favourite shows, and that you are a libertarian, how do these two facts relate to each other, if at all?
I don't think so at all. Mm. And partly because I've enjoyed it, no matter what my political opinions are. I mean, which have changed over the years. So no, I struggle to. I think anyway. Mm. I mean, the only thing I can say is, but they may appeal to the idea that things politically can be different, because a lot of Doctor Who, certainly in the early 70s, was microcosms of various political situations, whether it be the Cold War, what was going on in Rhodesia, what was going on in Northern Ireland. You could fit what was happening on the screen, even if it was with lizards, to these situations.
Yes.
Yes. And they did quite a lot of that. So what was my point?
One of the things libertarians of a certain kind, I think I'm one of them, says is that beneath and beyond political beliefs, libertarian, socialist or anything, there are deeper beliefs about what's right and wrong that are very widely shared. Not maybe universal, but very widely shared. Like, for example, the idea which is constantly banged on about on TV, that if you've committed a murder, it's not a defence to say that you're a very good citizen in all other ways. That is a deep, and I think that's a very widely shared idea, that the law's the law, and it doesn't matter if you're feeding starving children in Africa, whatever you're doing, you shouldn't have done that, and you should be punished.
Yes.
And it's noisy to defence to say that the stupid old woman you murdered was stupid, old and terrible. I mean, horrible woman. Mm-hmm. Still not a defence.
No.
And maybe what it is that we love television because we just share these sorts of ideas with everybody else. Not everybody, but almost everybody.
I mean, you're raising that sort of rather uncomfortable idea that I may share some ideas with communists.
The better sort of communists, the more deluded sort, who think that communism will bring about this fundamentally decent world. You and I both know they're talking out of their rear ends when they say things like that, but they do believe it. And a lot of socialists in England are socialists for what you might call good reasons. They want a good life. They want life to be flourishing. They don't want life to be anxious, miserable and suicidal, you know. And they think capitalism makes it all these things, and that socialism will correct all that. We don't agree, but we share with them quite a lot of basic notions. And TV, of course, because it doesn't want to piss off half its audience, very, very rarely says vote Conservative or even vote Labour. I mean, you know, it usually tries to keep out of those sorts of partisan expressions of politics. It's certainly in the drama. I mean, it is remarkable how little you know about the political allegiances of the main characters in TV dramas. You can guess, but they don't tell you. Why don't they tell you? Because they don't want 20, 30% of the audience switching off. So in other words, TV is drawn towards this foundation ethic of the rule of law, don't hit women, you know, basic notions of that sort. Does that make sense?
Oh, wow.
I don't think TV is completely saturated with socialist propaganda. I think there's quite a lot, but I think there are large areas where even if socialists are writing it, that isn't really the story that's being told.
I can mention Doctor Who because the original run ended in 1989 because it was rubbish and no one was watching it. But it was revised in 2005. And I found myself hiding behind the sofa in case one would get some sort of socialist platitude.
Mm.
And there was a lot of them.
Mm.
Or what seemed to be, or it was just... Maybe it wasn't socialist platitude so much. It was just let it all hang out, emotional drivel, for want of a better phrase. Mm. And yeah, I can't do better than that, because I would find these sort of remarks just ridiculous. And one part of it was in the early years of Doctor Who, the Doctor would be quite deliberative. He would
stiff upper lip.
But in some ways, that's part of it, but also the way he would investigate a situation. He would not instantly know the answer, and he would have to assemble the clues and think about it, and then he'd have to think about what his options were and how he was going to... And nothing would be simple. But in modern Who, it's all, it's sort of the click of the fingers, he instantly understands it, he instantly solves the problem. Some complainers, it's sort of Doctor Who is God, and it seems to me to be a world.
He used to be Sherlock Holmes, and now he's God.
Yes, it's the ethos has changed of the programme, and I find it's unwatchable as a consequence. And I put that down. Maybe I'm wrong too, but I just put that down to the infestation of TV by the left. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's just the way TV is done.
I don't know whether left is quite the word to describe it, but this reminds me of the mood when Princess Diana was killed, wasn't she, in an accident, and the whole country just went mad.
Yeah,
people who knew nothing about her and never met her and had no clue as to really anything except her, what she looked like and sounded like on television, behaved as if they'd lost their baby sister. I mean, and I found it very off-putting.
Yes.
That's what we're talking about, isn't it? Mm. That move from... Perhaps it's something to do with the fact that for a long time people lived through the war and had learned to just not talk about it. And then suddenly they hadn't. But it's something to do with the emotions and feelings. It's not straightforwardly political. But, of course, you and I both regard our political beliefs as in many ways a rational answer to emotional impulses that there's a problem, the government must grab some money and throw the money at the problem without any concern for what the larger effects of that kind of habit becomes. We regard many of the impulses of our political opponents as being impulses, emotional spasms, rather than thought through policies with a care for the long-term consequences of what they're recommending. And also the way that the policies are argued for. You're an uncaring brute if you believe that, I don't know, companies should be allowed to go bust, or people should be allowed, landlords should be allowed to eject tenants from their property, which I do believe.
Yeah,
I really believe that. I think the big reason why we've got a housing shortage, one of the many reasons, is precisely that idea is disapproved of so strongly. We connect that with an antagonism, with a contrast between rationality and emotional arguing. Bullying, sort of emotional bullying. Am I describing your point?
I think that almost perfectly. That's exactly my objection to modern
And you saw Doctor Who doing a switch from the good side to the bad side.
Yeah. Exactly that. And I think a lot of Doctor Who fans feel much the same. And they struggle to enjoy the new series, which is a great shame.
And that does seem to establish a link between the way you want thinking to be done and what things you enjoy on TV. What other things do you enjoy?
Are we talking about modern programmes or...
TV shows of any time?
One programme I absolutely adore is called Wheeler Dealers. Well, this may be showing my age here, but it's all about... there's a couple of blokes, they buy a car and then they do it up. But the nice thing about it is they show you how they do it up and they explain the various steps involved in improving a car and why they're doing what they're doing. And it's wonderful. It's just wonderful to watch. It's wonderful to learn. It's wonderful to see how, watch mechanics doing their stuff. And I very much enjoy it. This is another story, is that it's not quite ended, but the two guys involved, this is Mike Brewer and Ed China, had a falling out this year. Because these production companies decided to reduce the amount of space, amount of time, which is done on the garage segments. Now, to my mind, and indeed to the Ed China, who's the mechanics, that's the only reason to watch the programme.
Yes.
So it was all cheapening things and trying to make a quick buck. And China, to his credit, walked out. The really funny thing was that then the other guy, Mike Brewer, started getting death threats.
Well, I think that's the kind of dark side of the fact that people, not just in a general way, love television, but they fall in love with particular versions of television and then feel very hurt when it goes off in a different direction.
Yeah.
When Ghostbusters has women in it, oh, you've spoiled it completely. I mean, I just thought, why can't women bust ghosts, come on, it's not real.
Well, isn't there an element in
James Bond can't be black or something like that?
An element in that had they done this sort of thing 20 years ago, that would be okay. But nowadays it seems it's sort of, I hate to use, this is a cliche, pandering to political correctness. And I can't quite explain my objection to it. It's almost as if there's a certain element of cowardice about it. They've cast a woman as the latest doctor. Now, had they done it 10 years ago, it would have been brave, bold and interesting. But now it just seems as if they're being told what to do. And I don't think being told what to do makes a good drama. So, yes, there is an element there. I'm not sure I can expand on that particularly.
This leads us on to the subject of Top Gear, which again is a very political show. The left hates it and were delighted when it was ejected from the BBC because of Clarkson thumping one of the producers or something. I don't know what happened, but he didn't behave well.
No, that's exactly what happened. He thumped the producer.
And
let's face it, a lot of people on our side cheered him for that.
Yes. What I'm getting at is that there's a case of very political TV, because the car is very political. It's bad. It's like,
well,
guns.
It's certainly been made political.
It has. It's been politicised, yes. Mm-hmm. Speaking as a pedestrian living in London, I quite like the pedestrianisation of the middle of London, but I do get the point about cars and freedom and what they mean to so many people. We had a conversation recently about, we were thinking of doing a thing, one of these podcast things on transport, and you mentioned how you had become very fond of driving and preferred it to railways, which came as a bit of a surprise to me. I thought you were a railway nut.
Well, I am. I mean, I'm fascinated by railways, but I just don't particularly enjoy
traveling
by
them.
Train.
Yes,
actually. Given a choice, I mean, if it's a 50-50.
And it's all to do with being in control of the journey, isn't it?
It's not necessarily being at a wheel. I think there's a certain, you get privacy.
Privacy, well.
You tend to get a more comfortable journey in a car.
Mm.
It's also normally faster, yeah. Frankly.
Mm.
And it's more flexible. So there are elements to that.
But I think Top Gear celebrates the sheer... I think a lot of this... One of the reasons why the statement, I love television, why I wanted to make it, was because I think the idea of just enjoying something is almost becoming political now.
Mm.
I mean, we both write for Samizdata. One of the things about Samizdata is that, again and again, it has postings of people just saying, I love this. Maybe you don't. I get that. Yep. Commenters tell me it's stupid. Fine. But I love it. Whatever it is, you know, big butch jet airplanes or yachts or, you know, great big Top Gear stuff from all over the landscape.
This is the thing.
There was a wonderful moment when I remember being on a radio show and we were talking about a book in which a socialist had noticed that among a certain sort of socialist, smiling was right wing.
Yes.
The idea that sheer pleasure is a political thing.
In the 80s, they couldn't smile.
Hmm.
I mean, a lot of them couldn't smile. It was wrong. It was, what's there to smile at? You know, Thatcher's in charge.
Hmm.
So, yeah.
Hmm. If you smiled, you were tolerating everything wicked about the world.
Yes. Indeed.
Yes.
Indeed.
And so, therefore, maybe the statement, I love television, is a bit more of a libertarian manifesto than I had grasped. It's me saying, I'm going to do what I like, I'm going to watch TV, and I'm going to enjoy it, and okay, the world's going to hell, so what? I'm going to enjoy it. And I think central to being free is, you know, detaching yourself from all these political battles where you feel some sort of duty to be involved in them. If you don't want to, you don't have to. I think that, in the short run, that actually weakens the cause of liberty because people don't take it seriously. They say, it's the cause bit.
But
they don't
you're going
like,
to say in the
like
long
liberty.
Run it works out because people are more motivated when they actually do it. And
yeah.
They don't feel
well
obliged and
I don't
under
know.
Cost
I mean, maybe we're going to, maybe liberty's going to lose for exactly this reason. But let's hope not. It does mean that, so to speak, running the libertarian movement is a different project from running the socialist movement.
Well, I mean, you said this. I mean, you said this to me many years ago. It was a sort of like a huge relief, the idea that I was not bound to make an effort and I could actually check out from time to time.
Mm.
So I wouldn't, you know, wouldn't knock it.
Mm.
And I think being in some of these more doctrinaire, well, not doctrinaire is the wrong word, but sort of organised organisations, there must be a certain element of misery about it. You know.
Yes.
You're all going on this demo on a certain sort of day, and you're all going to, you know, wear this, and you're all going to, you know, carry these.
And if you don't, there's something wrong with you.
Yes, and you don't come around our place again. Yeah.
Okay, we veered off into we sort of.
Well, we were talking about Top Gear, and I think there's lots to be.
Mm.
We probably covered it just by the simple statement of, you know, enjoying oneself.
Mm.
But and one thing I found with Top Gear was that. It was simply the funniest thing on television.
Mm.
How a karate program can end up as the funniest thing on television is the weirdest thing.
Well,
it tells you an awful lot about comedy.
There's a definite feeling of three men in a boat about it, isn't
yes,
there?
Yes, yes.
Of three eccentric English nutters going off on preposterous adventures,
mm-hmm.
you know, racing a jet airplane to Venice or you know, whatever they're doing. You know,
yeah.
One of them's... Or they're trying to climb a mountain with a, I don't know, a bulldozer and a and a rock climber.
Don't give them ideas, or, you know.
And also the constant vendetta against caravans. Which is, there we are. We're laughing, and it's just sheer fun.
Mm.
Except for if you love caravans, it's not. So, Top Gear, right? Any others?
At the moment,
you mentioned the news. I mean. Do you enjoy, or have you enjoyed, watching TV news? And has that had the same depressing arc to it as Doctor Who?
Well, I wonder. I mean, if we go back in time, I mean, right now, I find TV news just impossible to watch.
Mm.
It is so obviously slanted towards communism that it's a joke. Joke is the wrong word, because it's not a joke. But why watch it? I mean, you find out what the socialists are thinking this week, maybe, or what the socialists are
thinking. Isn't it terrible that a government we like, the government of Germany, is in turmoil, even more than the British government, which we hate and detest and want to collapse, and that's in relative calm, and that's bad.
Well,
that seems to be the story.
Maybe I should watch it in that case.
Well, Angela Merkel
out of Schadenfreude. But yes.
Well, that happens to be the story right now. But there's a palpable air of regret about this. Of course, the extreme case was Brexit. they just couldn't be doing it. They still can't handle it. I like watching TV comedians in action, and it is fun checking them out for their politics. They are largely left wing.
Largely or exclusively?
Well, I don't know the details of how they organise it, but I suspect there's quite a bit of blackballing going on.
I suspect there is.
Yes.
Well, there was a thing. I mean, in the '70s, there were. Well, I can remember some fairly outrageous jokes being made by the likes of Bernard Manning and Jim. Well, certainly Bernard Manning. I'm not sure about Jim Davison, but I'm sure he could make some fairly off-colour jokes too.
Mm. Well, interestingly, the Pythons are not so much right-wing as leery of the left.
I mean, really?
Built into it a lot is, and John Cleese becomes more and more outspoken about. I mean, he's stopped being funny ever since he started seeing a psychiatrist. I think he's the most unfunny man I know, but he has become very, very angry about political correctness and censorship of comedy. At places like universities, where there are certain jokes not allowed. I think there's always been an anti-left strain in Monty Python. Think of those. Think of that scene where what have the Romans ever done for us? That scene. There's a definite air of
those colonialists.
People who are in charge may have their virtues. You know.
It wasn't just because it was funny.
Well, it was that as well. It was very funny, of course it was, but it was also there was politics in that little interchange, as of course there was in the one about the People's Front of Palestine and
Judea.
Judean
People's Front and the People's Front of Judea.
Yes. That was. I mean, if there's ever been a better send up of left wing fragmentary politics than that, I've not heard about it. So. I think they always had a sort of politically incorrect vibe about Monty Python. I mean if you get Terry Jones to one side and cross examining him, he's full of left wing platitudes.
And Michael Palin too.
That's right. I think it's quite interesting that Michael Palin. I haven't seen it yet, but they've just done a film called The Death of Stalin that a friend of mine was telling me was very good, and. Palin's in that.
As Stalin or?
No, he's not Stalin, because Stalin was.
I mean, it's odd. I mean, getting back to Monty Python, I felt there was an element about Monty Python which was a reaction by a bunch of public schoolboys who had been educated to be colonial administrators. And to find out all of a sudden that their colonies had
there
gone.
There were no colonies, yes.
To administer.
No, I agree. And I think the same sort of thing applied to Beyond the Fringe as well.
Yeah.
Before them. Mm-hmm. The feeling of a whole class that it was going to have to find some other way of living.
And I think there's a definite element of anger about Monty Python. Almost an element of wanting to burn the whole bloody house down.
Mm. Mm.
And I don't like that.
Mm.
I thought the house, yes, despite its faults, was worth keeping.
Mm.
You know, modifying in certain ways. But
well, what's the Roman Empire ever done for us actually asserts, you see.
They'd grown up by that stage. I suppose they were all in their 30s by then.
Well, I mean, the most important thing was to have a good joke. get a laugh.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the most important thing, always. Enjoyment trumped any considerations of rightness or wrongness. If it was funny, burning the house down, then good. If it was funny, defending the Roman Empire, equally good. Mm. If it was funny, having a go at Christianity, which they did in the life of Brian, person with the same name.
Yes, there's a word for that, isn't there?
It'll come namesake. To us in 3 hours' time. Yeah. Yes, namesake. But what other TV shows have you enjoyed? I keep asking you that, and then we keep talking about something else.
Which is the idea.
I think we should
you know, be keep quite happy to, you know,
good.
Get distracted and,
All right.
And fly off on tangents. I see no particular reason to keep on the subject. Yeah, what else do I like? Well, I tend to like, the Poirots. I liked the
Dame
Suchet Poirots. I think were very
well. That goes back to your fondness for early Doctor Who and puzzles. I think one of the deep ideas in a culture is, can you make sense of what's going on? Is it rational? I mean, the extreme case is Father Brown, where you would expect a priest to accept a degree of irrationality or supernaturalness about events. But he is the one always insisting that there's a logical explanation for what's going on.
Now, when you're talking about Father Brown, we're talking about, I'm a bit vague. This is G.K. Chesterton, or there's also TV
series. There's a TV version of it, And in a way, all of the TV shows celebrate the idea that life can make sense. We can work out what happened. And there's a sort of assumption that by the end of the episode it will be clear what happened and who did it. It celebrates, in other words, the capacity of human beings to understand things. Would that be the Poirot angle?
Wow. Well, I mean, Poirot is that on stilts.
Hmm.
I mean, obviously they were taking what Agatha Christie had written, and it was for the most part a very faithful adaptation of what she had written. You know, crucial things like, you know, her baddie was also their baddie, that sort of thing.
I like that. I must say, I don't like it when they screw around with books.
No.
If a book has been successful, then I don't think you should change the story. Mm-hmm. I hate that.
No.
I don't know why, but I do. Maybe I identify with the author and think, if I was the author, I'd be tossing and turning in my grave. I agree with you. One of the good things about Poirot is exactly that.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, the reason why I will not watch the modern Miss Marples is because they did start messing around with the books.
Really? Yeah. I haven't paid that much attention to either the books
or the best of my knowledge, TV. They started moving around.
Yeah. That's your belief.
It seemed to me.
But in a way, the Poirot and Miss Marple both are the template for a huge raft of TV shows, aren't they? Morse.
Yeah.
We've already mentioned Father Brown. There's dozens more. And all of them embody the principle that you can work out what happened. So people seem to like that belief. And I agree. I think when I think I'm up against somebody who regards the belief in making sense of things as itself some kind of vice which ought to be challenged.
There are people like this?
And there are, yes. Oh, I think so. I think it goes back to this rationality versus emotion thing. And the idea that rationality is some sort of vice for imprisoning people. I think the modern idea that white people are all racists is all mixed up with their excessive fondness for what they regard as rationality, in defiance of other ways of feeling and thinking.
Sorry, Brian, say that again.
Well,
the modern idea that all white people are racist.
Well, in America, that's quite widely asserted.
But other races cannot be racist, is that?
Yeah, I'm mixed up with that, yes.
Right.
Yes, and I think one of the notions they're getting at is that the very idea of being logical, of being like Doctor Who Mark I rather than
Doctor Who Mark II, yes.
is itself a kind of white fetish. Does that? I think I hear that.
Golly.
I mean, it goes back a long way. I can remember when hippies were saying, we despise your rationality. I remember a very interesting conversation at Essex University when I was about 20, and a professor of mathematics was defending the principle of logic, and he was particularly sensitive to claims that the Vietnam War was wicked because it was too logical. He was saying, no, if there's something wrong
what was the logic?
The demonstrators were complaining. They were saying things like, we despise your rationality, your imperialist logic. And this maths professor was saying, how dare you reject logic itself, rationality itself? If you do that, you are throwing away the most important weapon for criticizing bad government decisions. By all means, tell me that the Vietnam War is a mistake for the following reasons, based on false assumptions or false conclusions being drawn from true assumptions, false deductive processes. But don't throw away logic. That was what he said.
I seem to remember reading an LA pamphlet and used the word polylogism. Does that ring a bell at all?
I don't remember everything I've written, but...
It may not have been you writing it. It was the idea, and I think the suggestion was that Marx came up with this, that, you know, your logic depends on your... You know, where you are, your economic status.
Well, what things you think about, what problems you regard as important, are going to be a consequence of your position in life, partly. I mean, you may choose to regard something as important even if it doesn't affect you personally. I personally am not suffering from a housing shortage, but it scares the hell out of me what the effects of that will be on my country. And it's very bad news for all my friends who are suffering from a housing shortage by having to scrabble about for somewhere half decent to live. So I've lost the thread completely. But
we're talking about the rejection of rationality.
Yes, it seems to me that when you are confronted with somebody nasty trying to be very logical all over you, and because he's in charge, his logic wins. It's awfully tempting to reject the whole idea of logic as a sort of revolutionary reaction against tyranny. I mean, Hitler was very logical. I remember reading Mein Kampf and being struck by how logical it was. If you accept the axioms.
He's barking mad, yeah.
I mean, the axioms were false.
Yeah.
But the book itself was logical. The problem with Mein Kampf is not that it was an emotional rant. It's not, if you read it. The problem is that it's based on false axioms.
Yeah.
That's what's wrong with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how to argue against it. If you just argue against it as an emotional outpouring, well, you're just revealing the fact that you'd never read the damn thing. Because that is not what it's like when you read it. And that's what my professor of maths was saying. He was saying, do not disarm yourself by rejecting logic.
What else have you got if you don't have logic?
Well, there's all sorts of other things. You can throw rocks. You can get all excited. Yeah.
There you go.
Which is sometimes what we both believe in. So there you go. How does this relate to TV?
Yes, how do we go on to that subject? On this subject?
It was the glorification of the logic of the TV detectives.
Yes, yes.
And that seems to be... That is one of those deep ideas in our culture that strikes me as rather more contested than the proposition that it's no defence in murders to say that you're a very good person and all otherwise. I think almost everybody accepts that one. But I think rather more people who regard themselves as quite clever regard the logic of TV detectives is a fetish rather than a virtue.
Are people like this? Oh,
I think
goodness.
So. There are socialist opponents. I think they... I'm very struck by how in the 1920s, around that time, it would appear that the socialists were regarded as excessively logical and their opponents as rather antiquatedly, irrationally emotional.
Hmm.
And that seems to me to have been reversed.
But Agatha Christie, who was writing at the time, was no communist.
That's for sure. I agree. It's I'm making sweeping generalizations about the culture, and there's plenty of opposite versions of it. I'm thinking of writers like Bernard Shaw, who wrote tracts in favour of centralised command economy, the economy, which he asserted with great confidence would be more efficient. And a very distressing proportion of his opponents said that he was being too logical.
Whoops.
Which was a mistake. Mm. I mean, the best of the pro-capitalists at that time, the Austrians, von Mises, who was complete unknown at the time, as far as I can see, were being impeccably logical and good on them.
Yeah.
And gradually that habit of arguing, nitpicking the details and saying, no, if you do this, what will happen will be this. That habit gradually spread to the point where socialists started saying, oh, to hell with all this cleverness.
You know, it's odd you say that, because I have read von Mises' Socialism. And I felt, well, I had this feeling, really, that it may not be as logical as people tend to think it is.
Mm.
You know, he does make his point by one. He builds it up very, very carefully. But my feeling was that it doesn't take much. You only have to nitpick one or two, and the whole thing starts to fall down.
Of course,
as it happens, his conclusions
as the very existence of characters like Hercule Poirot illustrate, logic and passion go hand in hand. I mean, he has a passion,
yes,
for working out what happened.
Yes,
I mean that's the core of his being, and of course,
I mean, there's also a passion for justice as well. It certainly comes across in the TV programmes. I'm not quite sure if they're in the books. I suspect they are, because the TV programmes are
so
faithful to that adaptation. Mm. But yes, he does not regard murder as funny in any way at all.
Mm.
And that was something that would come across in the Doctor Who's. Every so often, the Doctor would make the point, this is not a joke.
Mm.
There was right and wrong here, a bit more importantly.